FM UK. Welcome to the bonus edition of The Stream. I like to think of it as a theatre encore when the cast comes back and performs another three numbers. In this show, we bring you the special conversations that happen after the live show has ended. Coming up, the growing humanitarian crisis in Somalia and the life-changing work of Women for Women International in Afghanistan and around the world. First, Gaza. The everyday struggle of living under a blockade rarely makes headlines. In a post-show discussion, guests Omar Shaker, Mahmoud Shalabi and Wafa Abdulrahman spoke personally about what it means to lack freedom of movement, have no security and live amongst the destruction of four wars. Here's Omar.
My colleague, the Human Rights Watch research assistant in the Gaza Strip, who is educated as one could be, works for an international organization, never left Gaza until the age of 31, until a couple of years ago, when we managed through various channels to get her a permit to leave Gaza, you know, for the first time. And I distinctly remember talking to her, you know, her first time out, and she described feeling like, you know, somebody who had been let out of a prison. And like a bird that was sort of exploring an entire world. And it just struck me, this reality that, you know, just because of where she was born, no matter, she pushed every possible wall as a woman, as someone born in Gaza, as a Palestinian, to reach the limits of education. And yet still, for three decades of her life, she wasn't able to leave the 40 by 11 kilometer piece of land. And that's, you know, something we've been able to help with a little bit. But tomorrow, when she moves to her next step, she goes back to being locked in that prison. And that's somebody who has access. Imagine, you know, the 2 million other people that don't have that sort of access.
Wafa.
The issue of stories. I have lots of stories, including my own. Like, I'm a Gazan. My family is there. So when you talk about the four wars on Gaza, actually, I had my family there, and I needed to connect with them. I live in Ramallah, but living in Ramallah, that doesn't mean that I had the ability and the freedom of movement, as many people might think. I spent 11 years unable to actually leave Ramallah, not even to go to other cities, let alone go to Gaza. So after 11 years, I got my address changed. I managed to get not a permit. I'm rejected by the Israelis. So I went through Egypt to Gaza, and I saw my family, my brothers and sisters. After 11 years, they're married. They have children that I have never met face to face. And I think the last time I was in Gaza was in 2018. I still have my mother.
Wafa, you say that so matter of fact. Like, all of us have experienced around the world being separated from family for 18 months, maybe still separated from family because we can't travel because of the pandemic. But you say, oh, I haven't seen my family for 11 years. That is not normal, Wafa. Are you just shrugging about it?
Yeah. I had my share of trying to deal with that. And every time I would bring it up, I would cry, because I wouldn't say I'm over it, because there was something very important to me during this period. I was very close to my father. I couldn't see him in 11 years. So when the first time we met, for me, I saw him for the first time that he grew really old, and I didn't want to see that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to believe. So, yes. So this is like, I think many Palestinians, they have this experience, whether they are, the worst thing, you are in Ramallah, so you are in the so-called Palestinian territory, but you cannot really go and see them, and we're talking about less than 1 hour and a half a drive in a car, and you cannot, and this is not because I don't have the money to do it, or I don't want to do it, or no, it's not a pandemic like the situation right now. So that was this is part of the story. And then I got married to this guy who's Palestinian, was born in Jordan, and now he's living my same experience, by the way. He doesn't have an ID. He wasn't granted an ID by the Israelis, because the Israelis, they control who lives here in the West Bank, who gets permits, who gets IDs, etc. So now we're waiting for family reunification. This year he will complete 10 years of imprisonment in Ramallah. It's almost history is repeating itself. I have a daughter that my parents never saw. My family in Gaza, they never saw. She's here with us. So the issue of movement, the issue of family unification, it is very personal, but why I'm dealing with it maybe in a different way. I'm almost on daily basis, I'm connected to Gaza because my office is there. We cover stories of women, children. We worked a lot during the Israeli war on Gaza in May. We had lots of stories, human stories that we tried to focus on. So when you look at what my family and my friends and the people of Gaza are going through, I know pain cannot be compared, but then you look at yourself and you look at them, and then you feel shy. Like, I cannot really talk about my suffering in front of a family that lost all its family members, all the members, or their children, or their parents, or a family that has their father or a brother spending 25 years imprisonment, or lost their legs or their eyes. We're covering lots of stories like this.
So well, I think you shared a chunk of your personal life, and I appreciate it. When I said tell a personal story, you literally told a personal story. Mahmoud, what do you want to add before we wrap up?
Two things, if you would allow me. One personal experience linking what Omar and Wafa said. So as a Palestinian, I wasn't born in Gaza. So I didn't have an ID. I was an un-Palestinian for a long period of time because Israel controls, you know, who gets an ID and who doesn't. So when I finally got my ID and I got a scholarship to study for my master's in the UK after the 2014 war, I want to show you the meaning of continuous trauma. When I went to the UK, I had 24 hours of electricity, hot water whenever I needed, freedom of movement, you know, going to Edinburgh, going to Scotland, and all the other, you know, places. And back in Gaza, I had my 4 months old son, who now is the, you know, the kid who recognizes the sounds of bombs. My wife, my mom and dad, and they didn't have the luxury that I was living in. When I returned back to Gaza, I had more gray hair than when I left, because I continuously kept thinking of the things that I had while they didn't. And the last conversation is one international guy, you know, asks this young Palestinian, what are your dreams? So the young Palestinian says, simple, you know, I want to get good education, to have a job, to marry the girl I love, you know, to buy a home, to have children and live safely. And the international guy tells the Palestinian, I was asking you about your dreams, not your rights. This is the reality that we are living in Gaza and as Palestinians.
The deeply empathetic Mahmoud Chalabi, a senior program manager for medical aid for Palestinians. Recently on the stream, my colleague Josh Rushing hosted a discussion about the increasing number of Somali people facing hunger and homelessness due to conflict and extreme weather. After the broadcast, Josh asked the guests how the involvement of other nations has impacted Somalia.
Somalia over the past 30 years has really, you know, been at the receiving end of this unilateral invasions, I would say. Ethiopia has really, as one of the countries in the region that has come sometimes to the aid of Somalia, but assumed, regarded by the Somali people as an invasion force, really come into the country once or twice, constantly trying to fix the politics, as you'd say, because they say we are a part a problem to the security of the region. But this really negatively affects the security situation, the political situation in Somalia, and has not helped security of the region in any way.
Josh, can I also just add to something that I think oftentimes gets missed when we do these kinds of discussions, and that is sort of the human toll on all these humanitarian crises. I remember looking at that footage of that elderly lady who clearly is in distress, and as a Somali, it really broke my heart to see those images all over again, because I remember interviewing the famous Somali novelist Nuruddin Farah. I think it would be exactly 10 years ago, 2011. And basically, I remember him saying something that really stuck with me, which is that it's really hard to be dignified, and I'm quoting him now, it's hard to be dignified when you're being rationed. And I think it just seems like Somali and Somalis are constantly in a state of being rationed by the international community. Hmm. And as Somalis, I just find it really heartbreaking, because it's really hard to be dignified, like he said, when you're constantly at the, the behest of others.
Yeah, what you said during the show stuck with me about 10 years on. You know, that quote was 10 years ago, and what has changed?
Yeah, yeah.
And what can we expect to be different between now and 2031?
Mm-hmm. That's the saddest part.
To be honest, yeah, that has been happening even before state collapse. I think the aid industry and this cyclical droughts and the weak government has been something. It's been something that has been ongoing for 20, 30 years now. So really, like York said, it's up to the Somali people to really work together. Political leaders work together so that we can eventually start to take responsibility for this, humanitarian crises for our own government. But also now with the international community more interested in, other conflicts, say the Sahel or even Ethiopia that seems to be imploding, I think it's really time for the Somali people to take on responsibility.
Yeah, it just seems like a lack of opportunity where you have a common saying that's when the animals go, you sign up to be a refugee. Like that seems really problematic in some way, particularly in the area of climate change.
Yeah. Yeah, it becomes so kind of a normal pattern, which is shouldn't be. It shouldn't be a normal pattern. Yeah, and maybe just a word also on the aid industry. I mentioned I've been around here for many years now, but on that side also things are changing. Yeah, we are trying more and more to work with local partners and to put more emphasis on local initiatives, and also put more responsibility and autonomy in local structures. So guys like me probably will slowly disappear, and I hope we have a different Somalia very soon. Yeah.
There's a kind of numbness to the Somali story, too, that you hinted at, Jörg, that if you looked at all of these factors, if you put them in any other country, the international community would be going crazy, like to respond. But because it's coming out of Somalia, it's like, well, it's Somalia again, and that surely has got to make hamper efforts to help there. I would assume that people are inured to the suffering of Somalis, I would guess.
Yeah, and for me, this is a very sad part of it. Please go ahead, Samira.
There is the constant. There's a constant name that they always say. Somalis are resilient, and I think this is part of the problem. This labeling of our resilience, and then forgetting that there's actually real problems that the people are grappling with, and I don't think the IC is really responsive to them at times. I don't think Jörg wanted to mention it, but the funding gap for the humanitarian response this year is around 41%, and I don't think that will be covered by many. So, and adding on to the COVID-19, the security challenges, just the Afghanistan, the cloud of Afghanistan over everybody, I think it's really, really time for, a different way of looking at Somalia.
Hey, how does the cloud of Afghanistan affect Somalia? How are those connected?
I think there is really a panic within, I think, international community circles on what exactly are we doing in Somalia and how are we delivering this aid. And as Jörg just mentioned, there is a need for swift and, flexible disbursement to local and community-based organizations, of course, with the, you know, proper accountability measures. There's a lot of money spent on Somalia, not just in the humanitarian sector, but also in the security sector. You know, we talk about $2 billion a year. And if you go, if you look at it on the ground, that the impact of that, of those resources, or even are those resources trickling down to the Somali people or making any difference, it's very hard to say. So there needs to be a different look at how things are done. Definitely, and Afghanistan, I think, after what happened there, I think the IC is now really looking back at their plans and, you know, trying not to to make the same mistake with Somalia.
Well, that makes sense.
But also, would you not agree, Samira, though, that Al-Shabaab and its leadership are looking at Afghanistan and the way the Taliban have been able to overrun that country and take it back in, like, a couple of days, and they're basically sitting there thinking, if we just bid our time and sit still, the international community will just eventually go away, and now we can have it all to ourselves.
So this has put wind in their sail,
for
sure.
That's been their narrative. It's been their narrative time and again that, you know, foreigners will always leave. And the way they have placed this argument is that this is actually an invasion force, and it started in 2007. I mean, it was triggered in 2007 by the invasion of Ethiopia. And then you have the AMISOM forces. We have approximately 19,000 AMISOM African Union forces in Somalia. So I think there's a lot of comparisons when you look at it that way. But I think there's also lessons to learn for the Somali government and the Somali people, that, you know, the difference between Al-Shabaab as an extremist terrorist group and the Taliban as, you know, an organization that was looking internally. And so there's a very interesting lesson there for us as well.
If you missed the Somalia episode or any Stream episode, go to stream.aljazeera.com to stream the Stream whenever you want to. Usually, in your average interview setup, it's the journalists who ask the guest questions. But when Laurie Adams, the CEO of Women for Women International, appeared on AJ Stream's Instagram Live series, she flipped the script on Josh Rushing.
Josh, you yourself have spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, I know. What do you think about going on?
It was heartbreaking. I've been getting messages from every Afghan I've ever known or worked with saying, you know, help me out, brother. They're going door to door looking for us. And I've done specials on interpreters who had been approved for their visa to come and then were stuck in a bureaucratic limbo for years, sometimes while the Taliban chased them. And that was, that was 5 years ago. And the sad part to me is how predictable all this was. I mean, I think I put in a report in 2009, someone saying that the U.S. may have all the watches, but the Taliban has all the time. It's just waiting for the U.S. to leave. And so everyone knew the U.S. was going to leave. I don't see why they didn't have, like, an evacuation plan on the shelf 10 years ago on how we're going to secure Kabul, get everyone there, and then we're going to have time to get everyone out before, you know, the U.S. backs out of Kabul. Like, all that should have been planned years and years and years ago. For the U.S. to be surprised that the Taliban went through the country so quickly, it's been evident. It's been obvious that every time that there wasn't some surge of Western forces, that the Taliban took over and had control. And so this was going to happen. And it's just shocking to me. And it's not like Kabul's that hard of a city to hold, in the sense that there's only so many roads into it. There's mountains that go all the way around it. They could have held the city for a little while they had time to get people out. It's like there was no intelligence whatsoever. I think that this goes beyond my place as a journalist, probably, but I think what you've had, at least in the U.S. military, is generals are steeped in telling their bosses that they can achieve what they're being told to achieve. And they're validated on that for years and years and years. And so you don't spend 30 years getting the validation for saying, yes, sir, we'll make that happen, to then be able to turn around and tell your boss, I don't think the end you're looking for can actually be achieved here. They could have told their boss that, generals, U.S. generals, could have told their boss that in 08. In 07, in 09, in 2010, you know, but instead what you have was every 12 to 18 months, a new one come in that says, oh, we got a new plan this time. And I interviewed them and said, what's different now than 5 years ago. It's like the same thing. Oh no, we've got it figured out this time. But that journal will be gone in 12 months, and a new journal will come in and have it all figured out, you know? And it's just so predictable. It's like watching a bulldozer move towards you an inch at a time for 10 years and not getting out of the way, which it's kind of like climate change in the same way. You just see this massive thing coming so predictably and so slowly, and no one getting out of the way of it. And it's so frustrating as a journalist to just keep doing the same stories over and over and over until it actually happens. And then do the story. It's like, yeah, that's what we've been saying for how many years, you know? It feels very frustrating as a journalist to watch this happen and to actually give a damn about the people on the ground and to think it didn't have to be this way.
No, it's heartbreaking. And I mean, the Afghanistan papers, I haven't read it myself, but I've been watching the news clips about it. And, you know, it documents how the U.S. investment was so, that we knew all along that it wasn't. So not only is there the failure to prepare, but the gazillions that was spent badly. So it's not anything was left behind. And so it's documented. And I think, but that's the important thing. Journalists, you play an incredibly important role to show us those facts. And we as citizens have to put on the pressure. So that's what we need to do. We need to shine a light on those facts, use those facts to say, this is unacceptable. This is absolutely unacceptable. And we need better from our government. And also, we're just going to have to act philanthropically and in solidarity ourselves, because while we try to get our government to do something better. And
I mean, what's different about the Afghanistan papers and the Pentagon papers from the 60s? Like, yes, the Pentagon knew in 65 Vietnam wasn't winnable. And most of those deaths occurred in 68, 69, 70. Like, I don't understand. They say journalists write the first pass at history, right? And then it gets edited. But it's just really frustrating when everything seems to be repeating in such a predictable and miserable way that we can't do better.
I mean, look, that's why, you know, that's why I'm in the civil society sector, is that governments do act in the interests of their perceived interests of their country perceived, because I don't believe this is actually in Ukraine, but they believe. And so that's why I'm in the nonprofit sector. That's why I'm not just in the movement sector, building movements, because governments act in their perceived interests, and we need to support citizens. We need to support families. We need to support women, and we have an opportunity to do that. So I spent a lot of my years as an advocate, and I think advocacy is still really important. But the reason I left pure advocacy, pure, you know, trying to get policy changed, was I thought, you know what? And it was Congo that did it for me. And if I had been in Afghanistan, it would have been in Afghanistan. In the 20 years it's going to take us to get a democratic Congolese government with the right policy, women's insides are falling out right now because what is being done to them. So let's provide some practical support even while we try to bring about the structural change, which is absolutely necessary, structural change. But right now, it feels really, really difficult. And I think a lesson is, you know, if you're an American, however much you love your U.S. government, the U.S. government going in to determine another country's future is not the way. The way is to invest in the citizens of that country to build their future, because it's nonsense that all people want, as we were just talking about, they want to invest in their families. They want to grow. They want peace. And so, you know, we can trust people that they will build a better future for all of us if we invest in them. Yes. And not have it be our governments that determine the future of another country.
That's just a short excerpt from a riveting conversation. You can watch it all on the AJ Stream IGTV page on Instagram. And that's our show for today. Laurie Adams and the work of Women for Women International inspired our closing slideshow, Afghan Women at Home and Abroad. Thanks for watching. See you next time.